Welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Hello, my dear audience. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Micro. As always, I hope you had a great week. And as you are listening to this, happy 2025. I hope you had a great holiday period. And if you took some time off, you know, you got to spend it with family, friends. You know, it's always nice to take some time off and relax. My holidays were a little interesting because I graduated from my master's and I had my graduation and it was great. And then shortly after that, I had influenza. So that's why I posted on social media that I was unable to record episodes and post episodes for, you know, the past 2 weeks. But I am definitely better now and I am so happy to be back talking micro with you. So thank you for your patience and here we are. As always, you can find Let's Talk Micro on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, Good Pods, wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find Let's Talk Micro. As far as social media, I am on Instagram, TikTok, Blue Sky Social, and YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, on X as Let's Talk Micro 1, on LinkedIn as Luis Plaza, and I have an email address which is letstalkmicro@outlook.com. So either via social media or via email, you can reach out with any suggestions, any feedback. As always, you know they are always welcome and appreciated. So please go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, download episodes, and if the app allows you to do so, please go ahead and leave a review. And thank you so much for your support. And if you are looking to learn more about antibiotics, please check out www.learnantibiotics.com and the Learn Antibiotics book available on Amazon. These resources include cheat sheets, practice tests, games, and more, and they are being used by thousands of people worldwide and may be helpful for you or your colleagues. So I invite you to check out these great resources from Dr. Timothy Gauthier, a very passionate pharmacist. And of course, if you haven't checked out the previous episode, which was the last episode of 2024, I invite you to check it out, which was with Dr. Alexander Sunderman. And he came to the podcast to talk about healthcare linens, and he talked about some outbreaks, he talked about mold in linens. It was definitely a great episode, so I invite you to check it out if you haven't already. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about today's episode. And those of you in the infectious diseases community, in the pharmacy community, the ID pharmacist community, you know, I definitely on social media, you see a lot of talk about sulopenem, which is an oral penem. And in the episode, Dr. Sam Aiken, who's an infectious diseases pharmacist from the University of Michigan, he joins the podcast to talk about sulopenem. And if the name sounds familiar, he was actually the co-author in the article which we had Dr. Ronim Palota as a guest, which was about E. coli and an NDM variant. And he was not a guest on the episode for that, but he was a co-author of the article, so his name was mentioned. So this time he joins the podcast to talk about sulopenem. And sulopenem, and if you've seen on social media, people are talking about it being an oral carbapenem, which is one of the things that he actually talks about in the podcast, which is not really a carbapenem. It is actually just a penem. And that is because, you know, carbapenems, they have a carbon as part of their structure, and sulopenem has sulfur. So that's the difference. So, but overall, when you're looking at social media, you might see that it is mentioned as an oral carbapenem. So we start with me asking him a question about, you know, when are carbapenems appropriate for therapy? He talks about that. We go over sulopenem, which was approved by the FDA under the name Orlynva, which is sulopenem with prevenacid. So I also ask him the question of why is it combined with prevenacid, and he talks about that. And of course, you know, one of the things that led me to do this episode was that you see different reactions about this drug on social media. So I asked him about what is the controversy about having an oral penem. And he goes on and he gives a great explanation and he talks about beta-lactams and, you know, oral antibiotics. And just for those of you that are listening that maybe are microbiology students or are like brand new medical laboratory scientists, when we talk about carbapenems, you know, those are part of the beta-lactam antibiotics. And there's an episode about that in the podcast, which I invite you to check it out. But definitely, it was such a great episode. I had such a great time talking with Dr. Aiken. All in all, such a great episode. So let's go ahead and listen to it. So those of you that listen to the podcast, you know that we did, you know, we have been doing a series about antibiotics, and maybe you follow social media or you might be aware of, maybe you heard about this carbapenem, sulopenem. So as I read the post and things like that, I thought it would be a good time to do an episode about it and talk about it. So with me today, I have Dr. Samuel Aiken to talk about sulopenem. Dr. Aiken, welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Thank you, Luis. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great having you. So for the audience, maybe you could tell them a little bit about what you do or anything else that you want to share.
Sure. So my name's Sam Aiken. I'm an infectious diseases pharmacist at the University of Michigan, or Michigan Medicine, as the hospital is known. And I've been here a little bit over 3 years. I do a mix of antimicrobial stewardship and infectious diseases consult. And, prior to moving here, Michigan, I had a career at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center down in Houston, Texas, where I did a mix, again, of antimicrobial stewardship, but mostly focused on infectious diseases consult in patients with hematologic malignancies, so leukemia and bone marrow transplant recipients. And there I developed a sort of side hobby slash career of doing a lot of AMR type research, so focusing on molecular epidemiology of AMR pathogens, particularly gram negatives. And I towards the end of my my time there, I got particularly interested in the evolution of resistance within individual patients and figuring out how that happened.
Well, sounds very interesting. So thank you again. And for the audience, I don't know if you remember, a few weeks back there was an episode that we did about NDM5 And it was, we talked about the guest was Ranin Palota, and we mentioned Sam Aiken, that was the co-author of the article. So this is him here today. So looking forward to this.
Love when things come full circle. And Ranin, if you're listening, I'm sorry for everything I did to you.
So let's start ahead with and definitely to the audience, check the episode that we did on beta-lactams. But just so we get a better understanding, so when are carbapenems an appropriate choice for therapy?
Yeah, so I mean, like everything, there will be the a little bit of the eye of the beholder, but I think the one thing that we can definitely say is a relatively established and proven recommendation would be for patients with serious infections caused by ESBL-producing pathogens. And the reason why I hesitated a little bit when I said relatively proven is I think it's pretty clear in my mind based on the results of the Marino trial and the observational literature that's available, but there are still some folks out there who try to parse out, severity of infection and inoculum and all these sorts of things. So I would say that the IDSA guidance certainly suggests the use of carbapenems for bacteremia and other serious infections caused by ESBL-producing pathogens. The European guidance also suggests similar recommendations, a little bit more nuanced. And you will occasionally find folks who try to use carbapenem-sparing regimens such as Piptazo for lower burden infections, so bacteremias from biliary sources or urinary sources. I frankly don't see the benefit and would just prefer to give the carbapenem there. Other situations, outside of the ESBLs, I think in a critically ill patient with an AMPC producing pathogen, I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do rather than, say, cefepime. You don't know if these patients may have picked up an ESBL on the top of their AMPC organism or if there's perhaps an AMPC mutant that leads to elevated cefepime MIC. So in the patients who are critically ill with a high-risk AMPC-producing pathogen, such as Enterobacter cloacae or Klebsiella, I tend to favor carbapenems there. And then out of the Enterobacter alleles entirely, certainly variations of Pseudomonas, you'd prefer to use a carbapenem, different forms of Acinetobacter baumannii and others. But I'd say within the Enterobacter alleles realm, the number one indication would be a systemic infection caused by an ESBL-producing pathogen.
Excellent, and thank you for that. As someone that works in the lab, I always love hearing what happens outside. We do the testing and hearing what they are used for, and that actually it brings my next question. So we're familiar with different carbapenems, and we know meropenem, erapenem, imipenem, for example. So is there like a criteria for choosing one over another?
Yeah, so it's really not the most clear delineation. Imipenem was, of course, the first carbapenem that became broadly available and tended to have the highest sort of rate of adverse events. So that's where carbapenems really got their bad reputation for being associated with seizures, which it certainly does. At the highest dose of the gram Q6 dosing for imipenem, somewhere around 20% of patients would experience a seizure on therapy, which is definitely not something we intend to happen. And then meropenem and ertapenem are the ones that are currently on the market. Doripenem was available in the United States for a while. May it rest in peace. That was a victim of a bad trial, unfortunately. But meropenem and ertapenem are still the ones that are most commonly used. Imipenem is sort of relegated to this mixed infection sort of role where Enterococcus is a predominant pathogen, since imipenem is the most active in vitro against Enterococcus faecalis. So it tends to be used there. You may also run into situations where an oddball Pseudomonas, where there's efflux but not porin issues, and imipenem is more active than meropenem, you might use it there. And then against Nocardia and atypical mycobacteria, imipenem would stand up there. In the Enterobacterales, there's very few reasons why one would want to use imipenem at this point, with one weird exception that I think is probably beyond the scope of this podcast, and I'm not sure is entirely proven yet, but I think imipenem is more durable against these porin mutant carbapenem resistant Enterobacterales than meropenem. I think it's less affected by that porin loss. That's just a hypothesis that I've put together. I have never seen any convincing data on it. So please don't take that and run with it and say that I told you to do so. Do not go there. So really the question now is mostly, when do you use meropenem versus ertapenem? And for a number of reasons, I tend to favor meropenem in inpatients. The reason being that meropenem is not a heavily protein-bound drug. It has a more reliable pharmacokinetic profile in patients, and it can be used at high doses like 2 grams Q8 as an extended infusion without really a significant amount of untoward effects. And we have good safety data now from the actual meropenem vapor Bactam trials, which use higher doses of meropenem. So I don't think there's any sort of safety signals with using that. The reason why ertapenem has been favored is really twofold. Is one, it is given once a day, which is a good thing, but from a kinetic perspective, it's barely a once a day agent. So anybody who has altered PK profiles, particularly with hypoalbuminemia, they may be at risk for treatment failure. You may wonder why hypoalbuminemia is a problem. And it turns out that protein-bound drugs, when they're highly bound to albumin, that is what allows them to have prolonged half-lives and why you can give ertapenem once a day. In patients with lower serum albumin, there's more free drug, which sounds like a good thing. Free drug kills bugs, but unfortunately, free drug is also excreted more. So if you have a patient who's hypoalbuminemic and ertapenem is being administered in that situation, the half-life decreases, and therefore you are at risk of underdosing ertapenem. The best data to say that this is a bad thing comes from Israel, where there's a really nice cohort study comparing ertapenem in hypoalbuminemic patients to meropenem in hypoalbuminemic patients. And it turns out that the effect of albumin, low albumin specifically, was dramatically accentuated in patients who received ertapenem in that scenario died way more frequently than patients who received meropenem with hypoalbuminemia. So to me, that is a compelling reason to avoid it in very sick patients or hypoalbuminemic patients. The other reason why historically ertapenem has been favored is because it supposedly spares Pseudomonas. And this is one of my favorite sort of things to get into. And I don't actually think it spares Pseudomonas. There's some debate back and forth in the literature on this. But if you actually look to the original studies of ertapenem, the original in vitro studies that were done, the MIC90 and MIC50 for ertapenem versus imipenem against Pseudomonas were identical. You can overlay the histograms for the MIC distributions, and you find pretty much a completely overlapping set of histograms. So, from an in vitro activity perspective, they're quite similar. The reason why ertapenem is not considered to be a Pseudomonas agent is solely because of its pharmacokinetics. It cannot achieve in the clinical concentrations needed to kill Pseudomonas. But what it does do, and you can see this pretty plainly in vitro, is it gets to the right concentrations to tickle and really irritate Pseudomonas and make it resistant to carbapenems. And in vitro, it readily selects for these OPRD mutants that are imipenem resistant. The clinical literature is very problematic because it's all basically a whole bunch of our hospital switched our formulary to ertapenem versus imipenem, and we didn't see any resistance in Pseudomonas. Therefore, it's a fine drug. And so the literature is a little bit back and forth as to whether ertapenem truly does spare Pseudomonas resistance. I don't think it does. The other situation is that ertapenem is very prone to selecting for non-carbapenemase producing carbapenem resistant Enterobacterales. All the carbapenems can do this, but ertapenem has a PK profile that, in the right mix of patients, so patients with, say, an uncontrolled intra-abdominal infection and neutropenia, it may select for these carbapenem resistant mutants that are not carbapenemase producers. And that was actually, it gave me a nice research career, that exact problem. I think it's a drug that you may or may not spare Pseudomonas, but I think is because of its relatively suboptimal PK profile in the right hosts, it actually selects out for potentially more resistance than you might see with our other carbapenems. So my personal advocacy is for inpatients, just use meropenem. And then, once they're transitioning home and whatever, and the initial inoculum's knocked down, you can probably use ertapenem just fine. This is a me thing. I think it's the right recommendation. It made into the guidance, the IDSA guidance to avoid ertapenem in patients' hypoalbuminemia. But, you ask a bunch of other people, and generally they'll say inpatient, we use ertapenem because it spares Pseudomonas and all these other things. So it's a favorite topic of mine. I have very strong opinions on it. Other people don't really think so strongly about it and probably don't even think about it all that often. But for me, it's a burning question.
So thank you for that amazing explanation. And I just, before I jump to the next question, as I'm thinking, because I was just going back to about what you said. So, but ertapenem is it's IV or is it oral?
Ertapenem is IV. There's no oral formulation. So this is we'll be talking about sulopenem here. Which will be the first oral version. But ertapenem is IV once a day versus imipenem, which is every 6 hours generally, or meropenem, which is every eight.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, so now, so now let's go ahead and talk about, sulopenem and actually, the name, Orlynvah. So can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so just one point of clarification. Everybody's calling sulopenem a carbapenem. It technically is not. It is technically just a penem antibiotic. It has in that little, everybody learned the house with the garage, beta-lactam sort of thing. In the little house, the pinnacle of the house is a sulfur molecule in sulopenem, as opposed to carbon that you see in a carbapenem. So sulopenem is just a penem. But other than that, they're pretty much the same thing. Sulopenem is a drug that's was recently FDA approved for treatment of uncomplicated urinary tract infection in women. As far as I know, as of December 17th at 7:17 p.m. Eastern, it is not marketed yet. That is my understanding of it. Happy to chat about whatever you want with sulopenem.
Oh, yeah, I think that's, definitely starting with that about, what was it approved for and any specific organisms that it's intended for. And then the other question is that why is it combined with probenecid?
Yeah. So these are great questions. So again, sulopenem was FDA approved for the treatment of uncomplicated urinary tract infection in women, and that's a very specific indication. And how folks might clinically refer to uncomplicated UTI may be slightly different than how the FDA refers to it. But in this situation, it's really just relatively healthy women with lower urinary tract infection, i.e., cystitis. Caused by the typical, urinary pathogen. So overwhelmingly E. coli, a little bit of Klebsiella, some Proteus mirabilis mixed in there, and then like a smattering of other gram-negative organisms and Enterococcus. Staph saprophyticus, as far as I know, wasn't actually included in their trials. Everybody always lists Staph saprophyticus as like the fourth most common UTI organism. I don't think I've ever seen one in my practice. It's just one of these organisms that pops up as like, oh, you got to think about this, but I've never actually seen one. So anyways, this is a drug that was approved for that very specific indication, and this will probably come up, later when we talk about some of the concerns that people have with this. But again, lower urinary tract infection, uncomplicated, so no catheters, none of these sorts of things, in women specifically. So again, excluding men, where the concern might be prostate or ascending urinary tract infection. And I'm sorry, what was the I got caught up there. What was the other half of that question?
No, so why is it combined with probenecid?
Yeah, so probenecid is an interesting thing, and even the FDA didn't necessarily know why it was combined with probenecid. So probenecid is administered, it's not an antimicrobial agent, it's an old school gout therapy. What probenecid is given for is to, it's an inhibitor of the organic anion transporter, which is what allows drugs to be excreted into the urine and the kidneys. And so an old sort of trick of giving beta-lactam less frequently was to administer with probenecid. So you basically would prolong the half-life a little bit. So the half-life might go from an hour to 2 hours or something like that. And you might be able to get away with shortening the dosing interval in these drugs. From a pharmacokinetic perspective, the fancy way of saying this is that it increases the overall serum exposure of the drug. The interesting thing is that in this case specifically, sulopenem is not being administered for or given for systemic use. It's meant to be excreted into the urine. So why give a drug that blocks its excretion into the urine? And FDA, I don't know if you know this, but many drugs that are approved undergo what's called an advisory committee from the FDA. And they post these extensive, beautiful documents that FDA puts together, the submission packet from the company for approval and all these sorts of things. And the one that the FDA put together for this drug include a little section of like, why the heck is there probenecid in this thing? They phrase it a lot more nicely and in a more regulatory way. But it turns out that most of the drug still just gets excreted anyways in the urine. But it's just not clear why probenecid is in there. And probenecid is probably what causes a significant chunk of adverse events, particularly GI intolerance. It's just a weird, it was a weird thing. And I don't understand particularly why it's in there.
Okay. And as you mentioned, you know, this is an oral penem. So is this like the first one, or because I'm asking because I kind of, you know, as I started doing research and looking at some things, you know, I came across, you know, tebipenem. I don't know, maybe you could talk a little bit more about that and if it's the first oral penem or not.
Yeah, so in terms of the sequencing of when things became available or under FDA development, I'm actually not sure which one hit there first. Tebipenem had been available for a number of years, actually, in Japan, where it was used predominantly as a treatment of upper respiratory infections in children. My understanding in talking to folks who work in Japan is that nobody ever used the drug anyways, because it was a silly thing to give to a kid with Haemophilus influenza. But at some point, it entered into FDA development for complicated urinary tract infection, which is different than the thing that sulopenem is approved for, UUTI. So CUTI is including pyelonephritis, Foley catheters, prosthetic materials such as stents in the urinary tract, urinary tract infections in men, things like that. So tebipenem was the first one to be available in terms of Japan. I'm not sure which one entered development first, but they both were sort of neck and neck. In 2 years ago now, in 2022, tebipenem's phase three pivotal trial was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, where it was actually found to be non-inferior compared to ciprofloxacin for the treatment of complicated UTI. But it was issued what was called, or FDA issued what was called a continued response letter, meaning we're not approving your drug right now. There were some concerns with the dosing of the drug and its efficacy, particularly in ESBL-producing pathogens, as well as some other analyses related to, you know, issues with enterococci and other drugs that it was never, organisms that it was really never meant to cover. But in any event, regardless of what the reasons were, tebipenem was not approved at the time for complicated urinary tract infection. And as of right now, my understanding is that it's in development still by GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, as a drug for uncomplicated UTI as a step-down therapy. That's my understanding of its current state in the development process.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. And as you know, like as I mentioned, with like when this was posted like on social media, you see like different reactions and little, you know, different emojis and things like that. And it just, you know, it makes me, you know, think what's the like the controversy. And I know that based on, you know, I work on the lab and knowing that, right? So thinking, okay, this is not the first drug that is for, let's say, you know, when you think about carbapenems in general, not the first drug that you would use for treatment, you know, you think IV drugs or more of a, like a, perhaps like a hospital setting, that communication between, you know, ID, pharmacy and all that. And I don't know, it's like, what is the controversy? Is because it being an, you know, an oral drug, maybe it takes some of those things away and maybe it can be overused, or can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I just want to clarify one thing. I misspoke. It's not a continuing response letter. It's a complete response letter. I always mess that up in my head. So it's for anybody who wants to quote me on that, it was a complete response letter. Anyways, so, you know, I think there's a lot of concern, understandably so, with an oral carbapenem or an oral penem agent. Some of it is probably overblown. Some of it is probably legitimate. I think the gut reaction that many people have nowadays to any sort of a new antibiotic being developed is that, oh, this is great. We should never use this thing ever. And they just knee jerk onto the stewardship response of, oh, we have these great drugs. We need to lock them away forever. And I think that's probably ultimately not a productive conversation to have, because these drugs are being developed generally for organisms that we need. Of course, there are some drugs that there really, frankly, is not much medical need for. And, you know, things like, you know, plazomicin kind of failed in a lot of ways because there just wasn't the market for it. Not that plazomicin doesn't have its use, it just doesn't have a market. In contrast, oral carbapenems or oral agents for ESBL producing pathogens, that's a huge unmet need. So I don't think the knee-jerk reaction should necessarily be, oh, we have this thing, we can never use it, everybody's going to use it, it's going to be terrible. I think that is maybe counterproductive. However, I think the concerns for this is they are legitimate. And part of the reason why oral beta-lactams have historically been problematic is that they're poorly absorbed for the most part, and they have really crummy pharmacokinetic characteristics. Even if you take a well-absorbed set of beta-lactams, such as amoxicillin or cefalexin, those are both relatively well-absorbed beta-lactams that achieve pretty good concentrations relative to their IV equivalents if you have those. In other words, they have high bioavailability. The problem is if you give them at doses that are necessary to treat organisms is they're poorly tolerated. You just can't give somebody amoxicillin 2 grams every 4 hours or cefalexin 2 grams every 8 hours or every 6 hours and expect them to tolerate it for very long. Plus patients, once a drug gets beyond twice daily dosing, people forget to take like one of the doses in a day and 4 times a day. Nobody takes that. Like, are you going to wake up at 3 in the morning to pop your 2 grams of Keflex that makes you sick? No, you're not going to do that. So beta-lactams are relatively impractical, even if they are highly bioavailable. Some of the drugs that are given less frequently, such as cefpodoxime or, say, ceftonir, they have really poor bioavailability and they're poorly tolerated when you try to dose them up. So it's just not a good combination. And sulopenem is a drug that I think is, from a pharmacokinetic perspective, probably not optimal at all. It is very poorly absorbed. It is highly dependent on food for absorption. So, you have to give your twice a day drug that, by the way, will make you nauseous because of all the probenecid with it, into with a meal twice a day. That's just a challenging thing for people to do. People are busy, they're on the run. They might not be eating at the time they need to take this drug. They forget about it, and then, ooh, by the way, that's going to really affect the concentration. And it barely gets to the PK indices that you think of. That'll suppress the emergence of resistance. So you look at things like 2 log kill or 3 log kill in vitro, even with the optimal state of highly fed patients and all these other things, you're barely getting these concentrations you need to kill the organism. And that's just a recipe for asking for resistance to develop. And I think the problem is here specifically is sulopenem, it's FDA approved for uncomplicated urinary tract infection. But that's not the only place where we see ESBL producing pathogens where we'd like to give somebody an oral agent. We see ESBL producing pathogens in pneumonia. We see ESBL producing pathogens in pyelonephritis. We see it in diabetic foot infections. We see it all over the place. And the natural temptation would be, I want to give this person an oral medication. That's the new thing that everybody wants to give oral medications, and rightfully so. But it's really bad to do that with sulopenem because this is a poorly absorbed drug that people may not take under optimal conditions, and you're giving it for these infections that are more prone to develop resistance already. They're primed to do so, and you're giving it for an infection site that is protected, and you get lower concentrations of the drug. I think it's an absolute recipe for disaster if people start using this in an off-label manner. So I do think some of that concern is justified on top of, the issues that we saw in the trial. So sulopenem failed a complicated urinary tract infection trial because it failed to achieve microbiologic eradication. It failed a step-down trial for complicated intra-abdominal infection. Even in the current clinical trials, it did not seem to work terribly well in comparison to ciprofloxacin for fully susceptible pathogens. So it seemed to be a less effective drug than ciprofloxacin for patients with ciprofloxacin-susceptible pathogens. So I think there are a lot of concerns with these drugs that are potentially borne out with clinical data in terms of efficacy, and then what will likely be downstream selection of resistance when it's used in situations that don't perfectly match this clinical trial.
Okay. Well, this has definitely been more than I've learned so much here. And before we kind of start wrapping up the episode, is there anything else that you want to tell the audience or anything else to add at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting time, and I never thought I would hear myself say these words. It's an interesting time in uncomplicated urinary tract infections, which, all power to people who study these things, but it has never been like a disease state that really gets me revved up. But there's sulopenem that's approved now. It was developed. Another beta-lactam drug called pivmecillinam, which you may or may not be doing a podcast on, that was approved too. That's been approved for years in Europe, and that's been used. So that's there. And then in the pipeline, we have the reincarnation of tebipenem as step-down therapy, and then we also have gepotidacin, the non-quinolone gyrase inhibitor. It's also in late stage development. So it's just four drugs, all relatively close or approved, that makes an interesting sort of set of decisions that people have to make in terms of what they're going to value and what drugs they might use and what situation. So I think it's just a dynamic landscape for a disease state that really hasn't had much attention in decades.
Well, Dr. Aiken, once again, as I said, this has been so great, and I hope that in the future, I get to chat with you again in Let's Talk Micro. But definitely, thank you for taking the time to be on Let's Talk Micro.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do it, and thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And that, my dear audience, is the end of this episode. I hope you enjoy learning about sulopenem. As always, I enjoy sharing this information with you. Once again, I am so happy to be back recording episodes. Thank you for the support, and as always, stay tuned. Great things coming your way. So please continue bringing that passion to what you do. It is so important. You do such great work. And maybe if you didn't get a chance to take some time off during the holidays, maybe say take some time off now. It's always very important to rest, do fun things, maybe read movies, whatever, relaxes you. So, as always, stay motivated, stay safe, and of course, continue talking micro. Until the next time. Bye.